Welcome to We've Got Issues. I am Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to speak with Ryan Grimm, the DC Bureau Chief for The Intercept, about yet another police killing of a black man in America and what it says about who gets to enjoy Second Amendment rights and the right to defend their home. And also says something about the gun lobby's selective outrage. Then we're going to speak to Anya van Wagtendonck, whose name I hope I'm not mangling too badly, about some curious organizing around that Canadian wingnut trucker convoy, which I guess we shouldn't call a convoy at this point. It has become a siege of Ottawa, Canada, of sorts. Anya wrote about that for Grid News. This blockade or siege or convoy is inspiring far-right movements all over the world. Although it remains to be seen whether it will be replicated around the world, because they tried to do a trucker convoy in the UK, only a handful of cars and the usual idiots that turn out for anti-vax protests in London showed up. So it fizzled out miserably. It was not an impressive showing by the British truckers, quote unquote. But here at home, the Department of Homeland Security warned local police agencies this week to expect a bunch of right-wing truckers and anti-vaxxers and the like to possibly blockade Washington, D.C. Perhaps on Super Bowl Sunday, there's been scattered reports that the U.S. version of the trucker whatever revolt is gaining steam. And this is, we're going to talk to Anya about how this is all kind of transnational anyway. So that's something to look forward to. Anyway, we'll talk about more about that later, but we've got a really big show. So let's take a quick break and then come back with Ryan Grimm. Stay tuned. God of his finest, wonder what Optimum Prime is. Never underestimate your highness. Stripped in melanin, galaxy's finest. Put a bit of pressure on the spirit at the highest. Do it, I will. Do it, I will. If they don't believe me, then you betcha I will. If they don't believe me, then you betcha I will. Better be happy, love for the betcha I chill. Flow. Welcome back. I'm joined now by Ryan Grimm. Ryan is the Intercept's DC Bureau Chief, the host of their podcast, which is called Deconstructed, and of course the guy who punched Fox News host Jesse Waters in the mouth. Ryan, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
A grown man getting in a fist fight.
Huh? You know what? It was warranted.
What are you going to do?
No jury would convict.
Not in D.C.
Not in D.C., no. Ryan has a piece at The Intercept that caught my eye this week. It was indicative of a larger issue, I think, which is whose gun rights are really protected by the police and also by the gun lobby. Ryan, let's begin at the beginning of this story. Who was Amir Locke and how did he die last week?
Well, Amir Locke was a young man who made the fatal mistake of sleeping over at a friend's house, going to sleep on the couch, and middle of the night, for young men, middle of the night is 6 a.m. The police just come barging in with a no-knock warrant. They had gotten a key from the landlord, so at least they didn't do one of those gigantic rams that they often use to smash down a door. Right. They can quietly announce themselves, but if everybody's asleep, what good is quietly announcing themselves? And so they come bursting in, and according to the body cam footage, you can see Amir kind of being woken up by the armed intruders, storming in, and he's got a blanket over top of him, and he starts fumbling around for a gun, a legal gun that he owns. He's got his hand on it, you know, for all the could have been a remote control. It was his gun. He wasn't pointing it at the officers. He wasn't even putting his finger on the trigger. And within seconds of the door being blown open, they fire three shots into him and end his life with the, they never should have been there in the first place using, you know, with this kind of a warrant, but there were clearly other options, just jumping on, you know, everyone knows somebody that you've woken up before in your life. They're asleep. You can just jump on top of them. Like, so if they really felt like they were in fear and there was some risk, you know, they were just feet away from him. But they made the calculation in their minds instantly that the best thing for them to do in that moment was to squeeze the trigger and put bullets through this blanket and kill this young man.
The police body cam footage shows that they opened fire 9 seconds after entering the apartment. And I think it's really important that we make clear that Amir Locke was not a suspect in any crime. Right. The police were looking for Amir Locke's 17-year-old cousin who lived in a different apartment in the same building. He was 7 floors away. It was his apartment. And the case is almost an exact parallel to the police killing of Breonna Taylor. In that case, neither Taylor nor her boyfriend were alleged to have committed a crime themselves. The cops were after like an ex-boyfriend who mm-hmm. lived several miles away. In that case, the cops said they announced themselves, but there is no evidence to back that claim up. Taylor's boyfriend, I'm just going to go through it because it's so similar. Taylor's boyfriend said they did not hear any announcement and they thought someone was breaking in. He fired his legally owned weapon at what he thought were burglars and police fired a hail of bullets indiscriminately that killed Taylor in her sleep. One cop was indicted for recklessly discharging his weapon, but nobody was ever charged for killing the young medical worker.
Yeah, and Taylor's boyfriend actually, even more specifically, thought it was Taylor's ex-boyfriend.
Breaking in.
Right, because you know, that can happen. A relationship ends, guy's upset about how the relationship ends. Now he's angry at both his ex-girlfriend and the new boyfriend. And so, you know, that's a reasonable fear that a couple would have, that the former boyfriend would come barging through the door armed, looking for trouble. Like, that happens. And just one more reason why police shouldn't impersonate former boyfriends barging through doors.
Yeah, and then the police tried to deflect blame for the entire incident onto the former boyfriend, again, who lived miles away from Taylor's apartment. Ryan, what does it say to you about American policing that we could have an almost identical police killing of an innocent person after the first one gained so much national attention, right? This is the thing that blows me away. It was the focus. The Breonna Taylor killing was a focus of massive protests. There was a criminal case. Again, nobody was found guilty of killing her, but there were repercussions for the cop who opened fire indiscriminately through a portico or whatever. There was a $12 million settlement by the city of St. Louis for Taylor's family in a wrongful death case. This happens, and then they do the exact same thing.
And I think police did notice that the officer who murdered George Floyd went to prison for it. And so I think that you're going to see a change in very precise behavior. Like, I don't think you're going to see a situation for a long time where with video cameras rolling, an officer kneels on a man's neck with other officers around him. Like, and so, but that's how precise the situation is going to have to be, you know, for there to have been, you know, change coming from those protests. And I think what the police also noticed is that that the police in the Breonna Taylor case did not go to prison. Right. Like, I think that was recognized across the board. And if all of them had been prosecuted for what had happened, just barging into somebody's house, immediately pulling a trigger, killing Breonna Taylor, then I think they would be much more reluctant to carry out these no-knock raids, because, you know, their argument for why they need to carry these out is that it's safer for them to do it this way, and that they it's also harder for then the criminals to get, to flush down the evidence or to get rid of the evidence or get away or whatever. But the first part, it's not always safer, because if you surprise someone in the dead of night in a country that has hundreds of millions of weapons, like eventually people are going to shoot back at you. And so that you're actually putting yourself in danger by doing this. But two, if it becomes risky for them from a criminal perspective, like if there's a chance that they're going to get prosecuted as a result of these, then they're going to be more less likely to do those. Because, the second last thing that a cop wants after, getting killed is getting sent to prison, because that is not a good place for police officers to be.
That's right.
And so there has to be some sense that there are some consequences. And as a result of there not being consequences in the Breonna Taylor case, there wasn't that deterrence. And when it comes to both Amir Locke and Keith, I don't remember Keith's last name, who was shot but not killed by Louisville police they're both legal gun owners. And then it goes to this question about why is it that their legal gun rights don't carry the same weight as they as say a George Zimmerman, or the other people that the NRA stands up for.
No, this is a really key point, and I think it's important to point out that the killing of Breonna Taylor, it was a little different in that her boyfriend, Keith Walker is his name, he did fire on the cops, and the police, of course, they insist that we judge this in a very narrow perspective of like what happened in response to those gunshots. Mm-hmm. And the internal investigation, although there was not a criminal charges, there was a departmental investigation, and they found that it was poor planning and poor execution. Sloppy police work led to the situation.
Yes.
And set up that moment. So you can't just judge it by that moment. And of course, this Anton Locke killing is different in the sense that he was not pointing a weapon at anybody at the time that he was killed.
Right. And their sloppiness is not new either. Yeah. In fact, it's been there's been a Simpsons episode about it. You remember, that famous scene where Sheriff Quimby, or I guess that's the mayor, the sheriff.
Yeah.
He barges into somebody's house and all the police storm in, and they're like, they say who they're looking for, and the guy says, you got the wrong house, and he's like, oh geez, again.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It's that was 20 or 30 years ago that it was a national joke that police were constantly knocking down the wrong door. And so there is a provision in kind of common law, stand your ground law, that says that, if you are the one who instigated the conflict, then you lose your self-defense rights. Now, the NRA has tried to, shear that away and say that, no, you can actually start a conflict, you can start a fight, and then you can cite that fight as the thing that caused you to kill this person. Like, that's how the NRA would like it to be. But yes. That's not traditionally how self-defense has been understood. Self-defense, it has traditionally been understood that if you lose your self-defense protections if you started it, basically.
If you're the
aggressor. The five-year-old. Right. He started it.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So they started both of these.
I mean, I don't think that ever applied to the police, but it's important to note that they are really eroding that, and that's what stand your ground is about. You don't have a duty to retreat anymore.
Right.
You mentioned other similar cases. I think Philando Castile's case, which was also in the Minneapolis area, was one of the most egregious. Here was a guy who was pulled over for a broken taillight, mm-hmm. Driving with his partner and their young child. He told the cop that he had a licensed firearm, as the law requires. If a cop pulls you over, you have a gun in the car, you're supposed to tell them. And the cop there was a little back and forth, but the cop basically just shot him 5 times as he tried to give him his license in front of his girlfriend and 4-year-old daughter. In your piece, you talk about how the NRA, a group that always warns of like stormtroopers coming to take your guns and mm-hmm. your freedoms and whatever, tends to respond to police killings of Black people with legal guns, who are holding legal firearms. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, they just don't say anything. And if they say anything, they will ask whether or not, and then they, like whether or not Philando Castile had you know had to weed on him or something like that. The no angel response. So either they will kind of discredit the person who has been killed, or they will just absolutely say nothing, rather than saying, you know, we are concerned that a legal gun owner, simply for exercising his Second Amendment rights, is no longer alive. Like that would be an easy statement for if you are the NRA. Like that's an easy statement for a gun rights organization,
right,
to make if a gun owner is killed for owning a gun and or for having a gun on him. But they just simply don't do that. I had asked the NRA for comment on this particular killing on Monday, I guess it was, and the next day they got back to me and said they had a longstanding policy that they don't comment on ongoing investigations. And what really they're that's not right. They comment on all sorts of things.
Sure.
But what really is going on here is that a couple things. One is the culture war angle here. Like they have chosen sides in a culture war. They also have a business and cultural relationship with the police. Like they're involved in all sorts of police trainings. They have those relationships, and then they also have the culture war relationship with the police. And police and police fraternities and unions have taken a position that only 100% solidarity at all times, unless an exception is made, and an exception was nationally made for the officer who killed George Floyd. Like they decided to throw him overboard.
Yes.
But if an exception is not made, everyone must march in lockstep, and there can be no deviation. This is a blue line, and you're with us or you're against us. And so I think the NRA feels like it can't cross that line, or it will, lose its business relationships with police forces. And also it just feels like it is part of the, it's in a culture war with, and the police are their allies in this culture war.
Absolutely none of this should come as a surprise given the, rightward lurch of the NRA. It used to be like when I was a kid, it was actually a gun safety organization.
Right.
They would do training and stuff like that. I mean, that was the real NRA. And it, in the 70s, it was taken over by a small group of far right ideologues and steered to be allies with the conservative movement in this country. So when they say, good guy with a gun, white is implied in that just because of the nature of their ideological perspective. Your piece starts with this good and provocative lead, which I will quote. The first gun control organization in the United States, you write, was formed after the Civil War by white Southerners bothered by the fact that enslaved people were now free, entitled to vote, and arming themselves to defend that freedom. The group called itself the Ku Klux Klan and organized for the first time in 1866. Can you run down this this history that you bring to this piece and kind of connect it to what we've been talking about today?
Yeah, and what people might not realize when they think back to that period of time is the small population of not just the United States but particularly of the South. Like, what was the population then? Something like 30 to 35 million. Nationally, that was like the entire, non-Native American population of the United States. And, half a million had been slaughtered in the Civil War. And in the South, there were a lot of places where freedmen and freed people made up a majority of those regions and arguably made up a majority of the entire South. And given the right to vote, and also for a while, given property in parts of Georgia, there was a real path toward, economic and political black power. And in order to, make sure that they could maintain that power, a lot of black communities had armed themselves. And there had been a number of people who had escaped slavery, who had served in the Union Army, Others who had already been free in the north, who had enlisted, and many of those, you know, so now had military training and military experience as well. So they weren't just, you know, people who owned guns but didn't know what to do with them. And there were, you know, there's a lot of talk about the indiscriminate violence on the part of the KKK and other kind of white terror organizations at the time, but there was also shooting back. You know, a lot of black organizations and just independent black men and women, armed themselves to defend their communities. And this was something that the Klan just absolutely couldn't tolerate.
Yeah.
You know, the cowards that they were, they first, before they would raid communities, would use what legal methods they still clung to disarm the population so that they could then slaughter them with impunity. And so that was, and so the Klan, you know, pushed through a bunch of what they call black codes, and in places they just straight up banned based on race people from owning weapons. And when the federal government did manage to intervene, they would then pass those fake, you know, colorblind laws that were very similar to poll taxes, that would say, okay, you know, you can own a weapon, but you need a license from the sheriff in order to own a weapon. And here's the sheriff. Come on, ask him for a license. Come on down. This is the guy you're going to get a license from. And that guy is just absolutely not giving anybody black in the area a license to own a gun.
Yeah.
And so they would use those types of, and then they even banned, when that couldn't work, they banned all of these really, really cheap guns. So that ended up catching up poor whites, but you know, the Klan has always been, you know, and the Klan and other white power groups have always been willing to throw poor whites overboard if they have to,
right?
In order to disempower black communities. And so, yeah, so the Klan was the first gun control organization in the U.S. Really.
It's a fascinating history, and it does connect with what's going on today. We did an episode, maybe 3 or 4 months ago, about the Not Fucking Around Coalition, this black militia that made an appearance at a few events, a few protests during the summer of racial justice protests in 2020. And its leader was arrested and prosecuted on charges that critics say were dubious. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, we see this kind of double standard. Kyle Rittenhouse hailed as a hero, utilizing the protections of these very, very lax laws to get away with killing people after he began a confrontation, and black folks not enjoying those same rights.
Right. And exactly. In the 1960s, you know, people might forget that the name of the Black Panthers, the actual name is the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And the most provocative thing they would do is they would exercise these legal open carry laws in California, walking around, you know, with weapons openly, even walking into the state capitol. It turned out to be tactically a blunder. But they were making the point that this is legal. And, you know, I've seen gun control advocates joke that, you know, the only way to get Republicans on board would be to do that again, because as soon as the Black Panthers started openly carrying weapons, all of a sudden, Republicans started calling for gun bans, and the NRA backed, as I write about in that piece, the NRA backed that bill in California to come after the Black Panthers. It was a gun control bill, and it was signed by Ronald Reagan, you know, who then the NRA then endorsed for president and endorsed for re-election.
Yeah. And of course, Fred Hampton, the leader of the Black Panthers, was murdered by Chicago Police Department in the 60s. Ryan, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. This is a disturbing reality that I think people need to know about. I really appreciate it.
You got it.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back. I want to feel the wind in my back. I want to run, run, run. And we are back. I'm happy to welcome Anya Van Wagtendonk to the show. Anya covers misinformation for Grid, which you can check out at grid.news. And she co-authored with a couple of colleagues a piece titled "The Hacked Account and Suspicious Donations Behind the Canadian Trucker Protests." Anya, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. So, I mean, just in case people have not been paying attention, let's just give them a little, what is going on up in Ottawa and at several points on the U.S.-Canadian border right now?
Yeah, so this has been going on now about 2 weeks. What started out as kind of a protest against a pretty industry-specific vaccine mandate, so that would require international truckers going across the U.S.-Canada border to be vaccinated, has kind of really taken on a lot of anti-government sentiments more broadly, both across Canada, different points of entry, as you just alluded to, as well as in other countries, including the U.S. And specifically in Ottawa, that's really kind of been the center of it. It has been 2 weeks of kind of nonstop protests, different sizes throughout the 2 weeks. At this point, it really is kind of the last few hundred, holdouts. Over the weekend, though, it was quite a bit bigger, about 8,000 people, local police estimated. And it has really just been ongoing, really centered around the trucking industry and the imagery of long-haul trucks. But by no means is it only truckers participating. Right. But that's really been sort of the face of it. And the messaging around it is that this is like sort of on behalf of the professional freedoms of the trucking industry.
And it's turned out to be a huge pain in the ass of the people of Ottawa. There's a poll that showed like 80 some odd percent of locals want them to clear out. And there's been a lot of complaints about noise and honking all the time. I find it hard to escape some parallels between this action up in Canada and the January 6th insurrection here at home. That's not an original observation, of course. Both are assaults on the capital of a democracy by a group kind of representing a relatively small minority. According to reports, there are kind of two distinct groups in Ottawa. You have like pissed off anti-vaxxers and families and goofballs who believe in various conspiracy theories and are largely peaceful, at least so far, even if they heckle people and there's been some tension at times. And then according to reports, there is another group of more hardened individuals, including, according to the Canadian Broadcast Company, people with police and military experience who may be helping in terms of logistics and et cetera, et cetera. And that is very much what we saw on January 6th. There were like the MAGA tourists and the guy with the big horns who didn't know what they were doing. And then there were some kind of random thugs fighting with cops. And then the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys allegedly trained for the insurrection and had a plan to at least delay the transfer of power. Are you seeing connections between January 6th and this movement or action when you look at the networks that are promoting it on like social media?
Yeah, I think that there are some parallels to be drawn, but I think it's also important to kind of distinguish between the really kind of distilled political fury of January 6th, which was very much around, as you mentioned, a constitutionally mandated process that was taking place that day at the Capitol in an attempt to overturn it. This is really, I think, taken on because it's been 2 weeks, because it's kind of this like more entrenched and at this point more distilled movement. I think it is important to draw parallels between kind of American right-wing movements, because so much of that imagery and rhetoric has really kind of made its way north without necessarily dismissing the things that make it unique and trying to draw that parallel to January 6th. And so you're absolutely right that there are these kind of far right and extremist elements, folks who track kind of known hate groups in Canada, see familiar faces that they, that have been popping up throughout the protests. But there really is, as you mentioned, kind of this mix of folks who are all kind of tacking onto this broader movement. And because it has been going on for so long, it really, I think, gives a lot of different folks opportunities to kind of uphold whatever their kind of pet movement is. So whether that is far right and extremist, and there have been, you know, reports of Nazi swastika flags, Confederate flags, yeah. Three percenter imagery, which is sort of interesting in a Canadian context, yeah. as that is, you know, a specific reference to the American Revolution. Yeah. So I think that some of that kind of cross-border pollination is what feels really interesting and unique. And yeah, so I want to be careful about those kind of parallels to January 6th, because the goals, I think, are quite different. And the context is different as well.
Yeah, and I appreciate the nuance. I just reading up on this, like, I've seen some pieces. There was an op-ed, maybe it was on CNN.com, I'm not sure. But it was talking about how this is there is a uniquely Canadian flavor to this, as well as there being a lot of overlap. And you quoted a researcher in your piece saying, and I quote, for sure, a large part of this is driven by cultural narratives that have emerged from the United States. So even if there's like different goals and a different structure here, different grievances, you have that conservative, right-wing, white entitlement grievance, et cetera, et cetera. I mentioned in the intro that this has emboldened far-right groups around the world, partially because this has been so hard for local authorities to dislodge. The police up there have said that there may not be a policing answer to this. There may not be a policing resolution. They're raising fines for all sorts of things and trying to do what they can to nip this at the bud. And it looks like, according to the Department of Homeland Security, they're warning that we will have our own trucker siege here at home. There have been reports that has been gaining steam. How worried do you think we should be about truckers destabilizing supply chains and whatnot? There was some talk this week on Fox News. I think it was Tucker Carlson. He was talking about how a few thousand trucks could starve out American cities.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, first, it's important to note that even in this Canadian context, the folks who are protesting, some of whom, as I mentioned, are truckers, some of whom are not. Yeah. But those who are truckers, they do not represent the kind of broader trucking industry. Both the largest representation of trucking employers, the largest industry group, has come out against the protest and in favor of vaccines, as well as the largest truckers union, Teamsters Canada, has also come out against the protest and in favor of vaccines. And so, and something like 90% of Canadian truckers are vaccinated. And so it's not necessarily a representative movement, but I think that your broader point, which is that you don't need every trucker to kind of get on board with this in order to really kind of snarl supply chains and ports of entry, is very well taken. And I think something that's sort of an interesting irony here, and part of what my team and I have been trying to suss out as we try and understand kind of what is the authentic kind of impetus behind this, and what is the inauthentic and kind of coordinated online manipulation of this movement. I think an important sort of thing to notice there is that the folks who do choose to snarl bridges, as we've seen, you know, in Detroit and ports of entry, across the border, those are truckers kind of holding up other truckers, right? And so the people whose livelihoods are at stake are other truckers, because they are the ones kind of getting stuck at the bridges, unable to perform their jobs. And so I think it's just a really kind of interesting point here that, you know, this really important industry has quite a lot of power, but is also kind of purporting to speak for a broader populace, regardless of whether that's true. And again, to reiterate, in the Canadian context, where vaccines have really been kind of widely accepted, I think what we are seeing is a little bit of an adoption of American right-wing rhetoric and American kind of polarization that perhaps was less present in Canada up until quite recently.
Yeah, we're exporting this stuff. Let's talk a little bit about your reporting. A pretty odd story. You wrote about how some nice woman in Missouri has become an unwitting nexus for Truckmageddon organizing on Facebook. Tell us a little bit about that. How did that happen?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I worked on this story with my investigative colleague, Steve Riley, and my tech reporter colleague, Ben Powers. And so we were kind of looking at the online mechanics behind the organizing of this, as well as the fundraising of this. And Steve kind of came across, he was looking just into the largest Facebook groups that have been kind of coordinating this movement, and found one person's name across, I believe, five of them, which is sort of unusual to see and perhaps points to a significant organizer for us to be speaking to. And then when he actually reached out to her, it turned out that she was not the organizer. In fact, she had her account had been hacked and stolen several years before. Steve kind of has the receipts of her daughter attempting to get the account back well in advance of this occurring. And he was able to kind of verify that that had happened. And so it really, again, points to what in the misinformation universe is called inauthentic online behavior, coordinated inauthentic online behavior, very jargony, but just a way of saying that, you know, it is not necessarily real people behind the scenes making this happen and funding it, which is not to say that the people on the ground don't necessarily believe in what they are doing. And right. I think it's important to kind of pull out, again, the different motivations that people have here. But certainly, I think when you feel like there is a huge movement backing you, that can really help then propel a movement. And so there is that sort of back and forth between authentic and inauthentic behavior in a movement like this.
Whenever there is coordinated inauthentic online behavior, is there an acronym? Is it like KIAB or something? Acronym?
Yeah, it's that.
Yeah, okay.
You nailed it.
So whenever there's a KIAB going on, there's always someone who says, oh, it's the Russians. It must be the Russians. Is there any evidence for or against the proposition that there is external manipulation? Because I think that we have lots of internal forces that tend to manipulate groups online.
Yeah, I mean, not that we or other folks who have looked into this have seen in terms of like there being one clear fingerprint here.
Like Fancy Bear or something, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, I think that this points to kind of a larger issue, which is that there really seems to be a limited amount of accountability for folks who would kind of leverage, again, some legitimate political grievances or, you know, nobody's had a good time over the course of this pandemic. And so I right. think there's plenty of sort of emotions at play here, as well as these right-wing movements that have been kind of gaining strength. There's all kinds of sort of people and movements that can be leveraged here by people who traffic in misinformation, disinformation. And so whether it is, you know, X actor or Y actor, we're certainly trying to uncover who some of those people are. But I think it's just also important to kind of recognize how easy it is for whomever those actors are to leverage real people and their real experiences in order to gain power, gain a quick buck. I mean, we are certainly seeing a ton of fundraising going on here, and it's really unclear where a lot of the money is coming from, and then perhaps more importantly, where it is going.
Yeah, and that's been the story that we've seen over and over again. Certainly true of the MAGA movement, where there's been just an enormous amount of grifting. Fundraising has, of course, become a big part of this story after groups raised millions of dollars to support these protesters through GoFundMe, which then suspended the campaign and said they weren't going to pay out the money that had been raised because it was supporting illegal activities. That was after the cops requested that they did that. They have, despite that setback, raised a lot of money. CTV News reported that Americans may be donating more than Canadians to support the trucker siege, although that's not entirely clear. There have been some infighting here at home among like Republicans and right-wing activists as a result of January 6th. The Republican National Committee censured a couple of their own for working on the House Select Committee investigating the insurrection. And this week, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Utah Senator Mitt Romney kind of and other Republicans blasted the committee for describing the riots as a legitimate political discourse. You write that something similar is happening in Canada in response to this trucker siege among folks on the right. And I should note that in Canada, you know, they don't have that hard right dominant faction. It really is a country where the center right and the center left are where a bulk of the voters are. What is that looking like? How is that playing out?
Yeah, there's a couple of, I think, really important differences between the U.S. political structure and that in Canada, namely that they are a parliamentary system. And so they have also just not seen kind of the same level of polarization that we have because a parliamentary structure is kind of definitionally a coalition-based system. Yes. And one of the ways that that's played out has been through the pandemic, that there has really been consensus across the political spectrum in government on how to address COVID up until quite recently. So there was kind of universal consensus around lockdown measures and things like this. So although there isn't a federal mandate, provinces were responsible for kind of implementing their own procedures. There was relative uniformity there in a way that obviously we did not see here in the United States. And so I think it's really interesting that all of a sudden, so much of that polarization is starting to kind of emerge. And as you kind of alluded to, that's taking place in the confines of the Conservative Party in Canada, where the leader was just ousted, I think, like a week ago, and has been replaced by someone who has kind of aligned with more Trumpish language. Yeah, whatever. Trumpian, thank you. Yeah. Has been spotted wearing a MAGA hat, I should say, a red MAGA hat. And so I think that they are seeing some of that sort of center right versus far right jostling taking place, you know, several years after we first started seeing that take place. And I think that that's a fairly significant shift. Some of the political scientists that I've spoken to have really, urged us not to downplay how significant of a shift that is, both like culturally and politically in Canada.
And there was a piece last week, was it CBC commentary? I'm not sure. Saying that the Conservative Party up there is finding itself kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, because you have this core base, very activist base, that is pushing them to embrace the trucker siege, whereas the vast majority of Canadians, including, if not a majority, a plurality of Canadian conservatives, center-right conservatives, are opposed to the siege. But it's really interesting, both here and there, that we're at this point in the pandemic where, you know, most restrictions have been lifted. There are very minor, you know, mitigation measures in place at this point, and yet it seems like the people who are winning the debate about getting back to normal are inflamed and enraged in a way that almost you would think that they were losing. Anyway, I believe we are out of time. Anja van Wagtendonk, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I'd also like to thank Ryan Grimm and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks from Alternate and Ross Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you folks for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
Second period. Where players dance with skates aflash, the home team trails behind. But they grab the puck and go bursting up, and they're down across the line. They storm the trees like bumblebees. They travel like a burning flame. We see them slide the puck inside. It's a 1-1 hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game.